Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, semblances of normalcy are slowly returning to many parts of the country as tens of millions of people get vaccinated. That also means many people are now starting to return to their jobs in person. But should you have to return to in-person work, what are the benefits? Ahead on Insight, we'll weigh the pros and cons with a California-based economist. And a new sobering study has found suicide rates fell by almost half among white Americans, but doubled within the Black community during the pandemic. The study's lead researcher joins us with the difficult but eye-opening data. Plus, we'll talk with the authors of a new book, taking a look at all the ways COVID has changed how we get around and use our streets. But first, the California Democratic Convention was this weekend. Among the convention happenings was the party's discussion over Governor Newsom's recall strategy. CAP Radio politics reporter and California State of Mind podcast co-host Nicole Nixon joins us now to talk about it, including a proposal for universal basic income here in California. Welcome to Insight, Nicole.
Hi, Vicky.
Well, Nicole, let's just start things off with, when it comes to these conventions, why do parties hold these?
Yeah, these are called organizing conventions, and political parties hold them every year. They gather up their delegates, conduct party business, like updating their platform and electing officers to lead the party and to endorse political candidates. Normally, these take place in big convention halls in cities like San Francisco or San Diego. This one from the Democrats was virtual, and, it went like a virtual convention.
Yeah, and I think we're all very familiar with the Zoom and virtual meetings. So I would imagine the energy was a little bit more tempered as opposed to, you know, conventions of years past.
Totally. It's, I put a tweet out over the weekend kind of just to be funny, but tongue in cheek about pros and cons of virtual conventions. It is hard to gauge the crowd level at these things and the energy based on the speakers. That's one of the great things about attending these in person, is who gets the crowd riled up, and what issues do people applaud for, and what issues get kind of less applause. So the Democrats do say, though, that they will be back in person in 2022.
So what exactly happened this weekend? Walk us through it.
You know, mostly it was just a lot of short video speeches by elected leaders. I was more tuned in just to see how Democrats talked about and strategized about the recall. It did come up a lot, but this weekend there were also, you know, caucus meetings where groups get together to talk about specific issues and, of course, fundraising.
Right, of course. And, you know, obviously the recall, the looming recall, which is all but certain, is probably top of mind at this Democratic convention for this year. When it comes to that topic, what in particular stood out to you?
So, I mean, it wasn't necessarily surprising, but it was interesting to see statements of support for Newsom from most of the speakers. You had union leaders, you had progressive Democrats like Representative Barbara Lee. Even Vice President Kamala Harris gave the very last message on Saturday. She didn't mention the recall, but she said that she and President Biden support Newsom 100%. So I think that was kind of the theme of the weekend, was Gavin Newsom is our leader, our governor, and we're going to support him.
There were other high-ranking Democrats, you know, in addition to Vice President Kamala Harris, that spoke, such as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the newly appointed Attorney General, Bonta, as well as Senator Padilla. They praised Newsom, but what was interesting during the weekend was that they didn't take jabs at Republicans. Was that intentional, you think, given that at least two of them are up for re-election?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. There was a lot for them to talk about, and it's hard to get to all of those things in a virtual setting when you only have, you know, 2 or 3 minutes to put your message out there. So, you know, besides the recall, there was a lot of speeches, pushing support for President Biden's agenda, all these big proposals he's put out over the last few weeks, and just preparing for 2022. They might not have taken shots at Republicans, but a lot of talk about protecting vulnerable House Democrats like Josh Harder and Katie Porter and Mike Levin, who are GOP targets for this next election.
You know, finally, when it comes to the convention and talking about the recall, was there any kind of type of discouragement of other Democrats who may be weighing whether they want to join this recall and potentially run against the governor?
Yeah, not. I wouldn't say that was that wasn't out there like strongly. I think that was kind of a between the lines sort of message. Like their message was, we are going to be unified behind Newsom. Like I said, since the convention was virtual, couldn't really talk to people in person and or gauge that crowd energy. But I talked with a longtime Democratic strategist after, who used to work for Gray Davis, who was the governor who was recalled in 2003. The strategist said that he was really impressed by the messages shoring up support for Newsom this strong and this early. And that was not something that he saw at that Democratic convention in 2003.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio politics reporter and California State of Mind podcast co-host Nicole Nixon about the California Democratic Convention from this weekend and much more. So that leads us to your reporting last week on universal basic income. You know, can you first remind us what universal basic income is and why it's been trending lately?
Yeah, if we go back to 2018 or 2019, a lifetime ago, right? Andrew Yang was running for president as a Democrat. And one of his ideas that got a lot of attention was to give every adult in America $1,000 a month. And I think that he really made this conversation of universal basic income go kind of mainstream. But of course, in California, there was already this program in the works in Stockton. So they use donated dollars to give residents, 125 residents, $500 a month, no strings attached, no questions asked. And that program was seen as a success. It helped people have more stable income. They were able to find jobs faster. The program ended recently, but a study found that the recipients spent their money mostly on essentials like housing bills and food. Mm.
There's now a state push, correct, when it comes to universal basic income?
Yeah. So this proposal in the legislature, similar to Andrew Yang's proposal, would have given $1,000 a month, not to everybody, but to middle and income Californians. This would be based on the area median income of where you live. So if you earn a certain percent of that, you'd be eligible. And it would only be available to people who've lived in California for 3 years.
Why 3 years? Why is 3 years like the sweet spot?
Yeah, they didn't talk about that much, but I think it sort of would have served as a mechanism to discourage people just to move here to get it, right? And to kind of prioritize people who've been here longer.
And the Assembly Committee, they passed it last week, correct? I mean, it's going to continue to advance, but it is advancing.
Yeah, well, this is what's interesting to me. It passed a committee, but it's dead for the year. And lawmakers made it very clear that they kind of passed this as like a support for the author for bringing it forward. But the price tag for many of these lawmakers is just out of the question. There's no way to pay for this program. And it would be really expensive. It would like double the state budget. So, and there were other questions from lawmakers like, you know, would this lure people in from other states and how would it affect jobs and housing here? But, you know, I will say this is one of those bills where the author knew it wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to necessarily pass this year. It's run by Assemblyman Evan Lowe. He represents Silicon Valley. And he was just happy that this proposal got a hearing, that other lawmakers were asking questions and just having the conversation. He says it was the first time a universal basic income bill was taken up in the California legislature. So that was a milestone.
And even from county levels, at smaller local governments, other counties are looking at Stockton and what happened there with that pilot study, and they're actually implementing it in their own counties, correct?
Yeah, and we're also seeing cities like Los Angeles just proposed a program, San Francisco, Oakland. They're all sort of different on the details, but yeah, they see the success of the program in Stockton and the good sort of coverage and publicity it got and thinking about doing it here. And I'll also, there is an element here about, you know, how this relates to the pandemic and the economic just devastation we've seen for some people over the past year.
Does the recall affect anything like this or any other piece of significant legislation in general, especially when you just mentioned this universal basic income legislation that was introduced by the state assembly member would double the state budget?
Yeah, I think it's a good question about if or how the recall affects. I think it's just too soon to tell. I mean, I don't think this bill would have passed either way, but lawmakers are going to continue to push their bills forward, recall or not. Certainly, though, when it comes to the decisions that Newsom has to make on the state budget, and then later this year when he's signing legislation, those decisions will definitely be under a microscope as the recall moves forward.
Finally, we know that this piece of legislation is now effectively dead, but is there going to be a future for it in the next legislative session? Has even the state author discussed maybe reintroducing it in a different version?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be many years before we see something like this get any further. It would just have to come with a funding mechanism. State lawmakers have to pass a balanced budget. You're already seeing pushback on California's higher tax rate for wealthier people and for businesses. But like I said, the bill sponsor really took this as a win that they had the conversation, and he says he's really looking forward to continuing that in future years with other lawmakers and kind of refining this idea.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter and California State of Mind podcast co-host. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Up next, should you have to return to in-person work? We're going to weigh the pros and cons with a California-based economist as COVID restrictions continue to loosen. We'll also have a closer look at a new study that found suicide rates fell by almost half among white Americans during the pandemic, but doubled within the Black community. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org, or you can use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Many of us are starting to return to work in person as pandemic restrictions continue to loosen up and tens of millions of people get vaccinated for COVID-19. But with a return to in-person work brings some concerns and plenty of questions, like should you have to return to in-person work? Is your employer requiring you to return in person? Really, what are the benefits to working in person rather than if you just worked from home? And how does the COVID vaccine factor into all of this? I mean, understandably, there's a lot of uncertainty. Joining us now to talk about it and sift through all of that is economist at San Diego's Point Loma Nazarene University, Lynn Reaser. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. How are you? And we certainly are now approaching the other side. So what will it look like? There are definitely, as you indicated, some major challenges.
Exactly. I mean, when you're looking at it from an employer standpoint and an employee standpoint, what stands out to you as kind of sifting through this new normal, so to speak, when it comes to deciding whether to return to work in person or continuing as is with remote working?
Well, first of all, the business people have to figure out, do they require everyone to be vaccinated? And what kind of mask wearing policies do we require? So there's going to be a lot of give and take, differences in policies, and employees are going to have to respond. Do they like this new situation or not? So those are all major decisions that a company has to make before it even opens its doors. And then we're dealing with this whole concept of everybody thinks a hybrid model is the way to go. And it sounds great in theory, but it may be a lot more difficult in practice.
You mentioned on a larger scale when it just comes to the economy that California is still clawing back some of the huge job losses suffered during the pandemic, and that when it comes to the state's economy, it's recovering more slowly than the nation's.
Yes, of course, we shut down more of our economy to guard against the infections becoming much worse. But in that process, we really did see a stratification of our whole workforce. Basically three groups, the people who could work at home, and those were mainly white collar workers, the people in low income that were in essential businesses, grocery stores, healthcare, utilities, construction sites, some of those middle income, but a lot of low income. And then the people that were just totally unemployed in the whole leisure and hospitality industry. So we had those, that very significant stratification of our whole culture and workforce.
Yeah, and touching upon that when it comes to the tourism economy, I mean, California has a greater dependence on tourism when compared to other states, correct?
Yes, it is somewhat higher. But the good news is that the governor said that we will reopen in June. So all of those workers now will have a much better opportunity to get back in the job market.
When it comes to now deciding if people are going to return to in-person work, should it be mostly an employer choice? What role do employees have in this decision making?
Well, I think there's a general consensus that both should have a role to play, but it's going to have a lot of problems, just logistics, for instance. Who gets to work in person and when? I mean, everybody maybe want to take Friday off, or everybody may want to take Monday off. Well, then, you know, who gets the choice? And we found in education, the hybrid model sounds great in theory, but we found that people in remote situations felt like they just weren't getting the same experience as the people that were in class. So it didn't really work out all that perfectly that you would hope. And then finally, you know, people may miss having their own dedicated workspace because companies are saying, hey, we won't need all that office space. People can just share desks. Well, you know, not having your own private space may make you feel somewhat disconnected.
You know, some people may say, if the job has been getting done from home, what difference does it make if I'm actually there in person?
Well, young people could suffer a lot because they need that mentoring and that connection. And what we might end up in the future is young people wanting to be part of the scene, right? You know, face to face with people they can learn from, and older workers staying home and working remotely, which would be an unfortunate divide because you wouldn't have that mixing. And you might find, again, these divides in our society that we're trying to eliminate and have widespread mixing. So that could be an unfortunate outcome.
You mentioned when it comes to the pros, the mentorship that's available that you can't really get with the Zoom meeting or working at home. I think that's something that we don't initially think of on the front end. When it comes to the cons or some drawbacks of returning to in-person work, what stands out to you?
Well, again, I think the major con is that the scheduling, you know, just the logistics, like who gets to work at home and when. And then second, the experience of not having that personal connection. And people like, you know, you can imagine, and again, we've seen that in education, you've got a live in-person group of people meeting together, and then you're dialing in from the phone, and like, people just don't really listen to the people dialing in. It's just, you know, you're there, but you know, you're not really part of the group. And then finally, you know, not having that your own workspace, you know, where you can put all your stuff and your things and your family pictures. You can't do that if you're sharing a desk with somebody. You're kind of like a gypsy. You come in and, you know, you're one desk one day and you don't really have any attachment. So those are, you know, I think really the standout cons.
You also mentioned that not everybody is coming back to work for a myriad of circumstances that are understandable. Some people needed to care for their children or their parents. Some were just fearful of becoming infected at work or maybe finding a job, opting out, and some have just simply burned out. How does that all factor in as people need to start returning to work in person?
Well, the ending of the major fears of COVID and the vaccination, I think, will alleviate a lot of those problems. And I guess, you know, the one upside of this is that it could allow women to be higher participation in our workforce because they will have the opportunity to stay home and work be part of the workforce, but still take care of children. So that's, I think, an important positive benefit of this all greater ignition and working from home environment.
An interesting trend during this past year is the reality that a lot of people moved out of big cities and moved, you know, more inland, maybe out of state, and they were able to continue working because they were working remotely. When it comes to that dynamic, what impact do you think that's going to have as, you know, some employers want people to go back in person, but they don't actually live there anymore?
Well, for many companies, it's going to give them more flexibility so they can hire workers in more remote areas with lower wage levels. So that gives them an advantage there. It gives employees an advantage not to be all crowded in a city, and they can raise their children with more space and cheaper housing. But it certainly could be devastating for cities if you don't have those people coming back to the urban area. So those are all challenges that remain to be seen and could be quite significant in terms of changing our whole economic environment, cities versus suburbs.
How does the vaccine factor into this discussion and the overall conversation?
Well, it changes it dramatically because it could make us go back to more situations pre-pandemic normal. And so people may decide, well, yeah, being in the central city is really nice. Being with people is really good. And so this whole disconnected model may not be so great as we initially thought it was.
How do you think this is going to affect hiring practices and workplace practices in the years and decades to come?
I think it's going to be a major change in that we will have more companies using remote workers, and that people won't be as concentrated in the central cities as it was before. But I don't think it's going to do away with the predominance of most companies being in person and people wanting to interconnect and be relevant as they associate on a day-to-day basis.
Finally, as we start seeing this all kind of move forward, and if the reality is there's a decent chunk of the workforce that is still working remotely, how do you think this is going to affect the economy at large?
Well, the overall current is for an upswing in the economy. And so, as I said, that third group who've been unemployed, they're going to be coming back, and many of them, most of them, getting their jobs. So we're on the verge of a major boom in this economy. And I think that will really help all of us welcome the side after COVID.
Lynn Reeser is an economist at San Diego's Point Loma Nazarene University. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just tuning in, we were learning more about the pros and the cons of returning to in-person work. We're now turning to a sobering new study that found suicide rates fell by almost half among white Americans during the pandemic, but doubled within the Black community. A note that this may be difficult for some people to listen to. Dr. Paul Nestada is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and is the lead author of the study we just mentioned. Dr. Nestada joins us now, and welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just to start off, your study focused on data in Maryland and just the state of Maryland, but you compared data from three distinct time periods, correct?
Yeah, that's right. We were interested in how the pandemic played across time. So we were very interested in during the lockdown period in Maryland, which was also the time we had the most cases. So we looked at before that, during that, and then after the lockdown when reopening started in the state.
There were concerns early on like from the beginning of the pandemic about mental health and the toll on mental health and particularly suicides, just given the isolation and the loss of work. But the early findings are suggesting that may not have been the case except for one group, African-Americans.
Well, my study, just to reemphasize, is just focused on Maryland. So the national data that's come out shows that there has been maybe a slight decrease in suicides in general, which was surprising. Many of us expected there to be increases in suicide across the board because we were seeing reports of more suicidal thoughts, reports of more depression, more stress, you know, unsurprisingly during the pandemic, the suicide went down. My study looked just at Maryland and found that although, yeah, in general, there was a decrease in suicide among African-Americans, among Black Marylanders, as you mentioned, it increased. In fact, during the lockdown period, the suicide numbers doubled compared to historic years. There's been some other studies in other small areas, Connecticut, Chicago, that have found something very similar. Overall numbers go down, meaning white numbers go down, but Black numbers go up.
I think that probably highlights that on the macro perspective, looking at it, a decrease within those numbers are vulnerable populations that were impacted by COVID more than others. And it's kind of just confirmation of that, because we're seeing that in so many facets of life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very clear that this pandemic, you know, affected different populations in different ways. Something I've been saying a lot is that, you know, it was a big storm. We were stuck in a storm of the pandemic, but we were all in different boats. There were people that for them, the pandemic meant a chance to stay home and work on their sourdough recipes. But for other people, it meant job loss and isolation without any economic cushion. And that creates a sense of hopelessness and helplessness and exacerbates major depressive disorder and can lead to suicide. So it really depended on where people were starting from. And in this country, you know, obviously there's huge disparities in things like access to mental health care or healthcare in general. And in the way that people are treated by the healthcare system and other systems, depending on their race. So it was maybe not surprising to see that the Black population, which already showed higher rates of COVID infection, higher rates of COVID fatality once infected, just sort of a larger impact of the pandemic, would have this increased suicide rate that might be seen as a marker of higher distress. I think pretty clearly is a good marker of higher distress in the population level.
Walk us through the highlights of your study's findings.
Well, we looked at the first 6 months of the pandemic because that's the data we had in Maryland, right? So the first 6 months of 2020, I should say. So the first 2 months of 2020, January and February, COVID had not really hit yet. And so we made that period one. Then in early March, the first three cases of COVID were identified in Maryland. And that same day, the governor declared a state of emergency, started announced the closures of schools. So these things were happening in other states around the same time. And then a few months later, in late May, the governor then started opening the state up again. Cases were going down a little bit. And so some things opened, obviously not everything. And so we called that the reopening period. So we have pre-COVID, COVID lockdown, reopening. In the pre-COVID period, the suicide numbers across the board and in individual races looked very similar to they had in 2017, 18, and 19. During the lockdown is where the split happened. So during the lockdown, white suicide numbers dropped almost by half throughout the lockdown period, whereas Black suicide numbers practically doubled. I think they went up by almost 100%. And then after the reopening started, things started to even out again, and it kind of started to go back to the numbers we'd seen in past years, which had been pretty consistent. It was useful to sort of divide the periods that way because there's obviously other things going on in the world that would affect suicide rate and things that would affect people of different races differently. For instance, during that reopening period, near the end of my study period, was George Floyd's death. And that really reinvigorated the BLM movement that had obviously existed before, but really took on more momentum and increased all kinds of things on the good and bad side. Right. So if you're a Black American, the BLM movement, which came after the study, might have created some sense of hope that something was being done. On the other hand, it might have really emphasized the fact that you're in danger and that you know, things that you were already worrying about are now in the public stage, that your own safety regarding the police, that kind of thing. So there's a lot to untangle there, but this study really, by dividing the early 2020 into in these periods, we could see how just COVID impact would change suicides.
You mentioned that you looked at the years between 2017 to 2019. I mean, and of course, the pandemic last year. Did the just talking about metrics, did the population change at all during that time?
Well, that's a really good question, because we weren't looking at rates. We were looking at numbers of suicides. That's a great question. But no, there was no significant changes in Maryland's population. In the whole or race by race, pretty consistent.
What made you want to look at this? You pointed out in your piece that this is the first study to characterize suicide trends by race and ethnicity during COVID-19. What was your driving motivation for this?
Well, what I was really interested in originally was just looking at suicide as a whole. Suicidologists had been saying since the start of the pandemic that the pandemic represented this sort of confluence of factors that we expected to increase suicide, you know, economic loss, isolation, actual grief for people that are being lost, fear for your life. These things have all, in other situations, like in the SARS epidemic in Hong Kong earlier in the 21st century, had caused increases in suicide, especially in some subpopulations. In Hong Kong, it was in older women. So we wanted to see what suicide was doing in this context. And national data takes a long time to come out. So we worked on Maryland data because I work with the Maryland Medical Examiner. We get access to it early. And we're surprised to find a decrease in suicide in general. But when we disaggregated and looked race by race, that's when we saw this finding. And we did that because we knew the pandemic had hit Black Marylanders harder than white Marylanders, as so many things do. And so we wanted to look in this population specifically and found maybe even a stronger signal than I was expecting.
When it comes to the discussions and just the topic of suicide, has there been focus on suicides when it comes to communities of color, or is it predominantly focused on white Americans?
That's a great question. So there are some studies that focus on communities of color, but it's true that most of suicide research has been focused on whites and actually specifically white men. And one of the reasons for that has been that there's just very high rates of suicide in white men. So something like 80% of suicides in America are male. And there's several times the rate of suicide in whites compared to Black Americans. And so there's been that focus. However, it's more and more being recognized that there are different sets of risk factors in men and women, in Black and white, in any number of subpopulations. And so it's so important that we have research that doesn't just look at the difference in those suicide rates, but actually looks at what specific risk factors there might be, what we could do to target those risk factors and then prevent suicide in these subpopulations. So there is more going on that way. There's a few amazing researchers like Sean Joe, Leslie Adams, that are doing work specifically in suicide in Black Americans and are really leading the way.
When looking at different demographics of individuals that commit suicide, are the demographics different? The age ranges different?
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of epidemiologic fact. But in general, the suicide rates are highest around age 50 and then again in the very old, like over age 80. But when we're looking at Black Americans specifically, there's actually slightly higher rates around age 20 or so. And then the rates kind of go down for the rest of the lifespan. And that's interesting. We also see that in American Indian populations, this sort of maybe even more dramatically, this higher rate in younger people. And it's unclear why that might be. But it's certainly something that requires a lot more study, because if we can figure this out, we can target prevention efforts specifically at these populations of young people and hopefully save some lives.
What else can the medical community do when it comes to this and help to curb this?
Well, one thing we really need to be doing is making sure that there's access to care, that there's equitable access to care. I mean, it's a well-known fact that it's much harder for Black Americans to access healthcare, and that includes mental health care. That has to do with insurance status and has to do with all kinds of things, even as simple as getting to appointments sometimes, which is why I'm really hopeful that now that we've made some shift towards telemedicine and telepsychiatry for the pandemic, that might stick around. We might be able to see access to care through that increasing. I know I've had many more patients asking me to see them from across the country in many cases, especially where my license provides, because they now can go to other doctors. They can't find someone locally, especially if you live kind of in an area without many psychiatrists. So I think that's a really helpful thing. I also think it's important on a public policy level to recognize that there was probably major economic components to some of the suffering that happened in the Black community. And so as we work on things like stimulus bills and things like rent forgiveness and student loan forgiveness, it's important we distribute those things equitably in such a way that the people that need them the most can get access to them.
As a psychiatrist and with a background in behavioral sciences, the past year with patients, and you said you were having an increasing number of patients reaching out across the country, what stays with you?
Well, I mean, one thing that really is hard to ignore is that the pandemic, even if it didn't increase suicide rates on a whole, increased distress in a number of ways that I wasn't even thinking about. A lot of it has to do with just changes in lifestyle. So the sudden shift from the way we used to live to the way that we have been living now created something that looked a lot like grief sort of grief for a loss of way of life, as opposed to for someone that you cared about. And that's required sort of treatment in more of the, what we consider Hopkins, the life story narrative, sort of reframing. Okay, well, this is not that your life is worse or less than, but let's look at what's different now. And there are some advantages, some disadvantages. So that's been something that I think will affect my practice in the future, that sort of reframing for what you might call an reductionist view adjustment disorder.
Finally, off the top of your head, are there any resources available for help?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important that if you or someone you know or care about is suffering from depression and might be having suicidal thoughts, the first thing to do is to ask them. It's never a mistake to ask directly. You don't plant the idea in anyone's head. I know you've been suffering. Have you thought about hurting yourself? Have you thought about ending your life? And following on from that, recognize that there are suicide crisis lines that vary from state to state. And there's a national one coming online soon, 988, not there yet. But you can also call 911. A lot of 911 calls are people that are worried that they're about to hurt themselves. And so an ambulance can be sent to get you to an emergency room if it is an emergency. But of course, a first step before getting to that crisis point might be making sure that you have good outpatient care, trying to find a psychiatrist or a therapist. They can help you navigate what ends up best viewed as an illness, depression.
Dr. Paul Nedstada is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Thanks for taking the time to join us this morning.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Still ahead, we're joined by the authors of a new book examining all the ways the pandemic has changed how we get around and use our streets. You can join the conversation, too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, the pandemic obviously has changed nearly every aspect of our lives, and that also includes the way we use our streets. City leaders have put in bike lanes, slowed cars down. They've allowed restaurants to put tables and large tents in the middle of the streets, and just so, so much more, which has in return changed the ways we get around and use our streets, really. I mean, in Sacramento has been no different. You can look at the Handel District, where the street has been shut off to cars and is now a restaurant sector, or the R Street corridor. In the foothills in Nevada County, cities like Nevada City and Grass Valley also shut down their main streets for a period of time just to make it easier to dine and shop safely. University of Oregon professors Mark Schlossberg and Rebecca Lewis, they published a new book called Rethinking Streets During COVID-19. They're taking a look at how the pandemic has changed the public use of streets around the world. Mark and Rebecca, join us now.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start off with, why take on how COVID has changed the way we use our city streets? What was it about the pandemic that led to these changes?
Yeah. You know, when we think of our streets, most of us look at them as very fixed, unmovable, unchangeable objects, where the primary purpose of them is to move or to store private vehicles. And what became clear during COVID in particular, is that we really needed to use this public space, the street, in a much different way, right? We needed to get out and exercise or move about our neighborhoods, but in spatially distant ways. At the beginning of the pandemic, the amount of car driving dropped, and so the capacity to sort of use that space and rethink it in a different way became more apparent, whether to move or to socialize, or as we've been opening up our restaurants, as you mentioned, the need for space so that our restaurants can have more seating became necessary. And so what we wanted to do was create a very public-facing, freely available case study book that shows the broader public what's actually possible to do with their streets not only during COVID, but perhaps sort of moving forward, that's different than just the movement and storage of private vehicles.
You know, after covering, you know, quite a number of city council meetings, when it comes to changing the use of streets, there can be some pushback. It can be a laborious process. But in the past year, I kind of just saw how quick and efficient they were to adapt to these pandemic restrictions. It was a pretty nimble process that stood out to me when compared to, you know, to previous years.
That's a really great point. Thanks for having us. So I think that was something that we really wanted to document as well, is that normally these processes take years. City council moves really slowly. There's lots of public process. And we spend a really long time deciding on making these changes. And what was so striking to us during this time was that it was really immediate, and it was responding to this need that we had that was different than before. I think what it has showed us also is that this was possible to do it more extensively and quicker before. And so we hope that the lessons that we share from these 25 case studies can help us in the future to help understand, you know, other ways of public process and other paths forward, and, you know, what worked and what didn't work in terms of these solutions.
When it comes to those 25 case studies, you know, you looked at places all over the world and across the United States. Which ones really stand out to you?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we picked 25 successful cases. So, you know, they're all pretty good to us. But what we wanted to do is show a range of the ways that cities have repurposed their streets. So some of the cases focus on like pop-up protected bike lanes, right? How to create really nice bike infrastructure immediately. Other cases showed how certain neighborhood streets were really closed off to through traffic. So they became kind of playgrounds for or social space for the neighborhood. Those are called slow streets, and other cases were really focused more on moving restaurants and businesses out sort of into the street to serve their purposes. So that's, you know, it's hard to pick a favorite child type of thing, but we think that the range of examples from a range of types of cities, so some big cities, some small towns, all across, mostly from the U.S., but all across the political spectrum, is really to show anyone in any community, hey, the stuff is possible, and the world's not going to end when you rethink the use of the public street to serve a greater public need. And hopefully through the range of the cases and the range of uses that cities have done with their streets, there's lessons to be derived no matter where you live in your own community.
Were there some instances where these changes were also disruptive? Were there any downsides to these adaptations?
That's a good question. We didn't focus on that as much, mostly because of how quickly we were working to document what had happened. We worked with city planners to make sure that we got the story right about how it got adopted and what it looked like. But what's really striking about a lot of these cases as well is that some of them were temporary, some of them are permanent, and now we're seeing that some of them are popping back. Where we live in Eugene, it was seen as a temporary fix, but when the weather got warmer, they decided to do it again. And so I think that there's definitely room to follow up on what's going on and what worked and what didn't work. I think there's also images and graphics within the book of things where you might look and say, you know, that looks really nice and I would like to spend time there. And some of the other ones you might think, oh, that was, you know, that's really quick and that doesn't look as aesthetically pleasing. So how could we improve it? And so I think in terms of your question around travel, sort of, you know, what was bad and what might have changed in a negative sense, I think being able to document some of these quick aesthetics and try to think about looking from the other cases to learn for ways that we can be improved or possibly streets that didn't work for this purpose.
Yeah, I liked one phrase that was used that people, us all in the United States, we are socially engineered to prefer cars. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's true. Our land use and our transportation investments and decision making, from federal investments in transportation infrastructure to local land use decisions that, you know, every city across the country have made, have basically made most households car dependent. So through our government policy, we've been socially engineered to be car dependent, which is a really different narrative than Americans love their cars, don't change anything about our streets. So the way that our transportation system exists is if you are unable to own and operate a car, you have much more limited access to all the things that we need in our life. And about a third of us can't own and operate a car. So anyone under the age of 16, you know, anyone who's physically able not to do it, or anyone who's economically not able to own and operate one. Yet, if you can't operate a car in most parts of most of our communities in the United States, you're really isolated. You don't have the same access to job opportunities, services, socializing, friendships, et cetera. And so we're trying to change the understanding of you can't ever do anything different with the street because Americans love their cars, to actually, we are been socially engineered to be car dependent based on local policy, and local policy and how we view the street can be done in different ways to serve a different public set of goals.
On that note, new street designs going on that is that it can contribute to really like an equitable community. You mentioned that some people, if they just don't have access to cars, that really affects all of the structures and the different arms of their life, from jobs and relationships.
Yeah, that's just absolutely true. We have a land use system that is born through a variety of policies, many with racist overtones that have been extremely exclusionary and divisive. And so, you know, from redlining all the way up to current exclusionary zoning policies that many, if not most, local communities follow. And these have real consequences in terms of equity, but there's also consequences about our public health, around meeting our climate change challenges, around just basic household affordability, municipal affordability. I mean, no community can afford to maintain the current street structure. So why we keep putting more money in to do more of the same is unclear. And so what we're trying to do in this book, which is actually the third in a series of case studies of showing how different communities can rethink the street. So what we're trying to do here is to show more people from the general public, like, hey, just because we've done it this way for 70 years, doesn't mean we have to keep doing it this way with our streets. So there's other social goals that we can achieve just by rethinking how we design our street.
This reminds me of just the past year, you know, the public health aspect of all of this. You know, we had such a wide spectrum of transportation options within just the city of Sacramento, from gig cars to scooters to electric bikes to obviously rideshare, that all came to a screeching halt for public health reasons. Looking ahead, and as we're rounding a corner, hopefully that becomes permanent, how important are reintroducing these types of transportation, especially even bicycles, back into our community?
That's a really great point. And I think that early on in the pandemic, we were all really shared of shared services and sharing air with other people. But I think the sort of current research on touching surfaces and those sorts of things is leading us to have a better understanding of particularly things like shared scooters and bike share. I know that around Eugene, where we live, people are using the bike share system really extensively. But it seems like there's definitely still a lot of fear around public transit, around bike share, around shared rides and these other sorts of things, which you're exactly right. It really changed the options that are available to people. And so I think that moving forward, cities and transit agencies need to think about how they're marketing and how they're sort of publicizing that it, you know, it is safe. Welcome back. These are the things that we've done. You're not going to catch COVID from the touching the surface, so that we allow these options to be widespread. I know that in New York in particular, there's been, you know, huge uptake of things like City Bike, people avoiding subways and using bikes instead. And so I think, you know, bikes and scooters almost will feel more safe than being in enclosed space. And so figuring out cities and transit agencies and bike share operators, figuring out ways to communicate that, I think are really important moving forward.
Finally, we know that all of these changes in the past year when it comes to the way we're using our streets was really a direct response to the pandemic. But how much do you think this is going to actually last in the long term and in future discussions of city planning?
Yeah, well, that's a big open question. I'd say over the last two decades in particular, there's been chipping away at thinking about how our streets can be used. And as Rebecca mentioned earlier, what's really unique during this COVID era was how quickly cities were able to respond and change the way that streets were used. And so I guess the way I view it is there's more people in more of our communities that have now had an experience on a street, either socializing or walking down the middle of it, or in a pop-up bike lane, or in a restaurant that was quote unquote in the street. So there's more people who have had different experiences during this era. And so the hope is that they'll put pressure on their local officials to make these things permanent and then even sort of nicer and better overall. That's the hope.
University of Oregon professors and authors of the new book, Rethinking Streets During COVID-19, Mark Schlossberg and Rebecca Lewis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. We'll catch you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.